I don't think I need to try to convince anyone here that what we're trying to do is very difficult. It's obvious from our own experience of the last few months that it's not easy to build up our members, even to those needed to form a truly viable organization, as I talked about a few weeks ago. It's not easy to bring new people to our meetings in the numbers we'd like. It's not easy to recruit more women and achieve the sexual balance we should have in order to become a truly organic community. The difficulties that we experience, I'm sure, tempt some of us to place less emphasis on the fundamental truth that we express in our affirmation and to turn instead toward gimmicks of one sort or another. If people won't listen to the truth, some of us may think, then we should talk to them instead about things that they're interested in. Income taxes, school busing, pornography, abortion, the right to keep and bear arms. Now, there's no doubt that right now we could win a greater response from the general public if we stopped talking about our purpose, our truth, and concentrated all our efforts instead on one of those topics. We'd also be more successful in a certain sense if we were careful not to mention the Jews or to talk about race. We could win more people, in other words, we could be a bigger organization if we would behave like conservatives or right-wingers. The reason is that most people have always been more interested in concrete, personal things like money, sex, their own safety and comfort, than in anything else. They've always been leery of anything controversial, anything that might be inconvenient or perhaps dangerous for them to get mixed up with. That's why conservatism has always been more popular than radicalism. And it's also why the two major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, have always been even more popular. They appeal to the public's basest instincts. They promise each segment of the population more of what most of them really want: more money, more comfort, more security. Now, I'm sure that no one expects us to try to out-Democrat the Democrats or out-Republican the Republicans. But we have to also understand that regardless of the difficulties it means for us now, we mustn't try to out-conservative the conservatives or the right-wingers either. Because while it's true that a conservative appeal based on immediate self-interest may win for us more people in the short run, in the long run, no appeal based primarily on self-interest can save us as a people from our present peril. No ad hoc program, no matter how cleverly disguised, is going to achieve our long-range goals for us. We're not going to sneak a sack over the Jews' heads under the pretense of being an anti-busing or an anti-income tax movement. And there will be no general awakening, no general uprising of the public anytime soon as a result of any conceivable right-wing program. No matter how unhappy people are about what's going on in the schools or about Henry Kissinger's program to liquidate white Rhodesia, the majority of them will keep on voting for the Democrats and the Republicans as long as they think that will allow them to keep their station wagons and all their shiny electrical appliances. And reasoning with them that their children or their grandchildren will be better off if they are willing to make some sacrifices now won't help either. We've talked about all of that before. It can be summed up this way. The great majority of people don't behave the way they do, primarily as the consequence of either reason or any idealistic impulses. They respond, most of them, to their crudest and simplest instincts. Herd instinct, or a compulsion to conform. Hunger, including the compulsion to accumulate money and other material goods besides food. And the instinct to avoid dangers and discomforts. Those are the instincts that the Democrats and the Republicans appeal to. The instincts the mass media appeal to. And if we want a massive public following, then we must ultimately, at some time in the future, appeal to the same instincts. It's no accident that all throughout history, fire and the sword have been the means necessary to bring the masses of people around to a radically new view of things. And the fact is that the other side has a monopoly on fire and swords, so to speak, at the present time. So that means that we must, for some time in the future, remain a minority movement. Not forever, of course. There will come a time of fire and swords, an axe time, a wolf time, as the old sagas say. And the great masses will come to see the error of their ways and will be persuaded to change their views and their allegiances. But we have much building to do, much long and hard work to do before we can hope to be sufficiently persuasive. And the way in which we must recruit our minority is not simply by copying the Democrats and the Republicans, that is, by appealing at this time to the same instincts that they appeal to. Because as I've already told you in our earlier meetings, the relative balance of power between us and the people that we're opposing being what it is today, we can recruit only fools in that way. Only a fool can believe that he will come out ahead with more money in the bank or with an easier or more comfortable or safer life by joining our fight, by opposing the Jews and their solidly entrenched power. And we certainly do not need fools for the work that lies ahead of us. We have to appeal to instinct because that's what motivates people, but it has to be a different instinct. And of course, you know what different instinct that is because we've talked about it many times before. It's the Creator's urge toward self-completion. It's the basic driving force behind the evolution of the universe. It's the most powerful, the most irresistible force in the universe, potentially. It lies slumbering in the souls of all of our people, even though in many it may be as difficult to detect as in a stone or in a lump of clay. In others, in a few, it predominates over all their other instincts. But even in those few, it's nearly always an unconscious force, unrecognized for what it really is. It's the instinct, the unconscious drive, which motivates the creative minority of our people, the poetic minority. We see it at work in our inventors and explorers and adventurers, in our poets and artists, but we also see evidence of this same instinct in every craftsman who does the best possible job he can in everything that he makes or repairs, not because that will earn him more money, but in order to satisfy an inner need. And it manifests itself every time that we feel a stirring, a response in our souls to something beautiful or noble or sublime. Every time our souls respond to something unrelated to herd instinct, or to hunger, or sex, or fear, or greed. The sort of response we have, or at least some of us have, every time that we view a beautiful sunset, or hear a tale of heroism, or first understand some new secret of nature, some new mystery of the Creator. This instinct is, as I've already said, very real. It exists. It's the divine spark, the fire of God in our souls, and it's potentially the most powerful force in the universe. When it's properly harnessed and directed, it will sweep the Jews and all their clever, practical, successful henchmen out of existence forever. The materialism and egoism which they have harnessed and which seem so powerful today will seem like straws in a hurricane. Of that, I'm sure. And I'm also sure that there is no other force which can prevail over our enemies. No clever right-wing gimmick, no pretending to be an anti-busing movement or an anti-income tax movement to build up our strength without the Jews or the masses realizing what we really are until we suddenly pull the rug out from under them. No, there's no other way but ours. Now, while we're building our strength, we must follow openly and straightforwardly the same path that we want our whole race to follow one day. That is the way to victory, and it's the only way. But as I said earlier, there are many difficulties in our path. This irresistible force that we want to harness is, even in most of those where it's strongest, an unconscious force. Its bearers do not recognize it for what it is, as the creator's urge inside them. Many are confused. Many even work for the enemy, perverting and distorting their creative instinct. So even though we know what the force, what the instinct is to which we want to appeal, we have problems. We have to make the minority in whom this instinct is strong recognize its true nature. And that is a great and difficult task of enlightenment, which we must perform. Very great and very difficult. And you may wonder whether we are really any better off now than we were when I started talking this evening. We already knew we had a big job in winning over enough people to make victory possible for our cause. And it may seem like I've just stated our problem in different words, and that contemplating the task ahead of us is just as discouraging as before. But if that's what you're thinking, you're wrong. I have not just stated our task in different words. I've showed you, or tried to show you, that our actual task is quite a bit different from what it may have seemed. That is, I've pointed out that instead of trying to win by appealing to an instinct that seems very weak in most people, instead of trying to awaken an idealism which seems completely smothered by materialism and egoism, instead of trying to make idealists out of materialists, instead of that, we're attempting to reach a minority of our people in whom the Creator's urge is naturally strong and educate them as to the true nature of that urge. We're not trying, in other words, to coax into life the very weak urge of the masses, but rather to waken into full consciousness the much stronger urge of the minority. And that's not only an altogether different task, but also a much more hopeful one. And when we've accomplished that task, then the other becomes feasible. Then we can think in terms of whatever it takes to persuade the masses. But the key to victory, the path for us now, is one of consciousness awakening and consciousness building. And I said that that is a more hopeful way. It's important for everyone to understand that. It's important to have as much hope as possible, because the more hopeful we are, then the harder and more effectively we work. So I hope you'll pardon me if I tell you a corny little story to illustrate the point that I've tried to make tonight. Once there were two friends, Larry and Bob. Larry was a salesman, and Bob was an electrician. They lived next door to each other in a quiet suburb, and they had known each other for quite a while. They both considered themselves right-wingers, Larry much more so than Bob. Both of them, in their work, were exposed every day to the worst elements, the worst influences in our society. And they both complained about the things that we all complain about school busing, about government favoritism toward blacks, about the bias of the news media. But when they got together to drink beer on Saturday afternoons, that was when Larry really used to expound to his friend Bob about politics and about what was wrong with things in general. Larry was fond of saying that Western civilization had gone down the drain at Stalingrad. When Europe, that is, when the Germans lost the Battle of Stalingrad in 1943, it was all over, he proclaimed. And then he went on to complain about the Jews. And Larry knew a lot about the Jews. He worked for a company owned by Jews, and he sold their products to other companies owned by Jews. He had to take them out to lunch and joke with them and be nice to them during the week. And on weekends, he let off steam by talking about politics to Bob. Bob talked some too, but mostly he listened to Larry. But the fact is that he actually worried and thought more about the things that Larry talked about than Larry did. If one could look into their souls, one would see a fundamental difference in the way Larry and Bob responded to the world around them. Larry, who made his living working with Jews, working for some and competing against others, hated them because they were tough and clever and tricky, and he really had to scramble to break even. And he knew how they collaborated with each other against the Gentile world and how they boosted each other and shared their secrets with each other. And he knew how much economic power they wielded. He was afraid of them and envious at the same time. And so he readily extended this hatred to cover all the other things beyond his business life that he knew they were responsible for. Racial mixing, pornography, gun control laws, and so on. But Bob was different. In his work, he came into contact with some Jewish businessmen and with some Jewish contractors, too. But he had never in his life met a Jewish electrician. And on the job, he wasn't constantly exposed to Jews the way Larry was. Bob had never really stopped to figure out why he was instinctively repelled from the Jews that he occasionally did meet. His conscious attitude toward Jews was based instead on observing the effect that they had on the world rather than on his own personal experience of them. Everything filthy, everything ugly and degenerate in the world seemed to have a Jew behind it. They were mixed up in everything that tended to weaken, to disorder, to corrupt society, and opposed everything strong, orderly, or decent. To be sure, Bob owed a lot of his knowledge of the Jewish involvement in various things, such as the news media, race-mixing efforts, to Larry's explanations. Well, actually, we wouldn't have to look into their souls to see a difference between Larry and Bob if we knew what to look for. Although both men earned about the same amount of money, Larry always seemed to spend more than Bob. Bob's family had two cars, both several years old. And Larry's had three cars, newer, bigger, and more expensive than Bob's. And Larry drank more and dressed in more expensive clothes than Bob. Of course, as a salesman, clothes were more important to him than to Bob. But Larry also spent more on his wife's clothes and on his house than Bob did. Every time a new model of electrical appliance came on the market, Larry had to buy one. And he was getting ready to send his two kids off to an expensive college. Bob, on the other hand, had decided that colleges being what they are these days, he had just as soon not send his kids to one, even if it might mean a less income for them someday. Actually, for some years past, Bob had been giving a lot of money to the church, several thousand dollars a year, in fact, in the vague hope that the church might have some kind of retarding effect on the processes of decay that he saw at work in the world around him. But he'd stopped his donations to the church last year when he was finally forced to conclude that the church really wasn't interested in opposing the things that Bob saw as the major problems in the country. In fact, the idea was beginning to gnaw at his subconscious mind that perhaps the church was itself one of the problems. You see, although Larry and Bob were pretty good friends and may have seemed a lot like the other people in their block, there was a subtle difference. Larry was basically an egoist and a materialist. He was, in fact, spiritually like most of the other people in the bloc, despite his outspoken right-wing views. But Bob was a member of the minority. His soul, unlike Larry's, was really out of tune with the suburban lifestyle. Larry, despite his griping about the Jews, was not basically discontented with his life. Bob, on the other hand, was. He felt there was something wrong, something missing, although he couldn't quite put his finger on it. Well, eventually, some things happened that made the subtle difference between Larry and Bob more apparent. Larry's Jewish boss decided to run for a seat on the local school board, and he asked Larry to be his campaign manager, since most of the voters were Gentiles. Now, although Larry hated his boss's guts, he saw this as an opportunity for him to move ahead. He had been thinking for quite a while about demanding a higher rate of commission on his sales, and if he did this favor for his boss, he could almost certainly get that higher rate. So he campaigned for the boss. Even though he knew his boss secretly favored school busing and would certainly promote more race-mixing propaganda in the school classrooms if he won a seat on the school board. And on the first Saturday afternoon, after he had taken on this campaign work, he joked about it to Bob as they were drinking their beer. The way Larry looked at it, the world was screwed up anyway, and there just wasn't anything anyone could do to straighten it out or to clean it up. And so he might as well look out for himself and do whatever was necessary to get ahead. After all, everything had already gone down the drain at Stalingrad, as he always said. At least that seemed like a pretty good excuse to Larry for what he was doing. But what Larry had done bothered Bob a great deal, and he didn't drink as much beer or stay as long at Larry's home that Saturday afternoon as he usually did. And Bob, you see, didn't really know Larry's boss or his ideas on race mixing the way Larry did. In fact, he wasn't as sure as Larry was on a lot of things concerning the Jews. But it still didn't seem right to him that Larry, feeling the way he professed to feel, should be campaigning for a Jew, any Jew, regardless of how much more money he might end up making. And then something else happened that made the difference between Larry and Bob even more apparent. Someone they both knew only slightly, a fellow who lived on another street, but whom they often ran into in the neighborhood shopping center, and who had given Bob a lift once when his car stalled in the shopping center parking lot. This fellow invited both of them and their wives over to his house for pizza and beer one evening. And when they were all there, and Larry had been sounding off about politics the way he usually did when he felt he was among friends, the fellow who lived on the other street suggested they all listen to a tape recording of a meeting of a group that he belonged to. Well, of course, it was our National Alliance introductory meeting tape, and they all listened to it. After it was over, Larry made a few enthusiastic remarks about how much he agreed with the tape. But then when the fellow who had played the tape for them asked them to subscribe to a newspaper his group published, Larry looked at his watch and said, "Oh my gosh, I've got to run. I promised my boss I'd design a bumper sticker for his school board campaign this evening." He knew perfectly well that he couldn't afford to get involved in anything radical. It was all right to talk about these things, but he'd get fired in a minute if his boss found out he was actually involved in such activity. But Bob stayed a while and asked some questions. The tape had made real sense to him, and some things which had bothered him for a long time began to become clear. Well, to wind up the story, Bob continued thinking in the next few days about what he had heard, and he read the literature the fellow on the other street had given him, and the more he thought about everything, the more he realized that he had found something that was very interesting to him. Within a month, he had become a member of the Alliance, and was in turn looking for other people to play the Alliance's introductory meeting tape for. And in fact, that's the way he spent his Saturday afternoons from then on, instead of drinking beer with Larry. And he had increased his consciousness to such a point By the time the preacher from his church came around to see him one evening to ask for a donation to help support the church's missionary schools in India, that he laughed in the preacher's face and kicked him out of his house. Nowadays, Bob is working so hard and enthusiastically for the Alliance that he's recruiting an average of one new member a month. And he hasn't even noticed that Larry now has four big, expensive new cars and even a fiberglass speedboat as well in his driveway next door. Because his Jewish boss won that seat on the school board and is now giving Larry the higher commission rate that he wanted. In fact, Bob and Larry really don't see much of each other anymore, because Bob has realized, even if Larry hasn't, that they are different from each other in the most fundamental way. Bob's whole life now is guided and illuminated by the divine spark in his soul, while Larry's is too faint for him to notice. Bob is the sort of person that we're trying to recruit now, and he can be recruited because he has already inside him the necessary ingredients. All that was needed was for someone to aim his thinking in the right direction and explain a few things to him. But no amount of explanation or idealistic appeals will cause Larry to change his ways. He won't change until that hurricane comes along and blows all those new cars and that speedboat away. So our job now is to concentrate on this minority, the Bobs in our society around us. We have the tools, a few tools now. We will have more tools as time goes on. And I think that if we look at things in this new way, thinking instead of trying to win over a sizable section of the public that simply does not have it in themselves to respond at this time to what we're trying to tell them, but instead to awaken the consciousness in people, in this minority, this creative minority that does have this inside them, I think that we can have a lot more hope for continued growth and for continued success in the future.